Hello and welcome. This is Heavy Business. I'm Aaliyah.
And I'm Curtis.
And today we have on Emma. Thank you, Emma Kramer-Roger, also known as Ember Belladonna. And thank you so much for coming on the podcast. We're going to talk about video game music, film, sound design, et cetera, et cetera. Before we go too deep into those questions, though, Emma, would you be so kind as to give a brief summary of who you are and what you do?
Hi, thanks so much for having me. So my name is Emma. I work as a sound designer and audio technician, and that spans a bit across film, video games, and I am also a flute player. So I do a lot of session recording and release solo music under the name Ember Belladonna.
How long have you been playing? What's your musical background in general?
So I've been playing since I was 9 years old. So that is just over 20 years at this point. So it's been a while. I was put in music lessons at quite a young age. And then the flute was kind of the instrument that stuck, carried on with that into adulthood, did a music degree. So focused really heavily on that instrument. And kind of put it away for a little bit after university ended. And then the last few years have picked it up again and branched into session recording and solo music. And kind of through that time also started to learn more about audio production and branched out into that, which is how I started getting the work in film and video games.
Yeah, so how did you get involved with the film and video game industries?
So I had started initially doing a 9-month intensive course through Berkeley. It was an online course, and that sort of set the foundation for all of the elements I needed to learn, and very quickly got an internship at a post-production studio here in the province where I live. And that really set the foundation for me starting to work in film, especially. It was had a Dolby certified studio. So I got a lot of work really early on in all aspects of post-production for film. So Foley, sound editing, surround sound mixing, and was just able to branch out from there.
What was the experience of doing the Berkeley online course like?
I mean, I really liked it. It was a really good foundation. I mean, I wouldn't say it necessarily gave me all of the skills that I needed to really compete at a professional level, but it certainly laid the foundation for me to continue learning from that point and to have a good foundation to just continue learning and to continue my craft after that course ended.
Sounds very helpful. So what was the first big project that you worked on with video game or film?
So my very first film project was actually a Nicolas Cage film called The Humanity Bureau. And so that was the first one that I got to work on the whole post-production aspect. It was the first time I got to go to a movie theater and see my name go by in the credits. So that was really fun. And I did mainly sound effects editing and surround sound mixing for that one. So that was when I was working at a post-production studio, had full access to the full theater setup, full mixing gear that way. And it was really great to work on that and work with people who had been doing post-production work for decades. It was probably one of the best beginner projects I could have asked for, just because it helped skyrocket my skills so quickly.
How do you kind of get that kind of work where you live? Because Saskatchewan isn't really known for being like a hotspot for film and TV and stuff, at least as far as I'm aware.
Yeah. So, I mean, once upon a time, it had a pretty good industry. And over the last 10 years, that has kind of waned a little bit. So the post-production studio that I worked at, called Talking Dog Studio, I was there for almost 2 years, I think, and that was the last one in the province, and that shut down around 2019, I believe. So the film work I don't get to do much of anymore, because most of it does need to be mixed in a theater studio. So any of the video game work that I do now is all just from my home studio. It's all through connections online. It's all remote work, basically.
What is the broad scope of the things that you do within video games and film?
So working on film, most of the sound design stuff that ranges from Foley, which is doing recording for all the small movements on screen. So any, paper rustling, footsteps, anything like that, it's usually re-recorded and edited to have those sounds in the film. And then you get into sound design, which is creating the non-world sound effects. So that's like your explosions, your monsters, your magic, anything in that scope. I have worked a bit in dialogue editing, which is cleaning up anything that was recorded on set. So that is the primary work that I've done within film. In video games, I've done a lot of session recording for video game soundtracks. That's mostly recording flute, working with a composer. And the last year or so, I've been working a lot more in the sound design and implementation aspect. So that's creating all the sounds from scratch for anything that you'd need to see on screen, any sound that would happen on the on-screen action, and then implementing that as well. So working in the game development engine, whatever one the team happens to be using, making sure that the sounds fire at the appropriate time, making sure they're balanced properly and that they work properly in gameplay.
Well, so does that involve do you have to actually know coding for all these things, or you just kind of surveil it and make sure it's working right?
I mean, the coding is definitely an asset. It really depends on the project that you're working on. My coding is very minimal, so I typically work with the programmer, but there are a lot of tools that you can use, specifically middleware and certain game engine tools that you can use that allow you to really customize how your sounds are going to play back in the video game without knowing much past basic level coding.
I'm kind of curious, what does the scope of a project look like and the timeline look like? When you're given a job or you're hired for a project, what does that timeline look like, kind of, and generally, how do you organize your workflow?
For film work, typically the audio post-production is 8 months to a year, sometimes a little bit more. The workflow that I've always gone with that is working with your base audio. So that's anything that was recorded on set. And starting with that, cleaning up the dialogue, starting to implement your background noises, getting all of that laid, getting that foundation established. And then you're starting to add in your sound effects, your Foley. So when watching the film, you want to make sure that every single action on screen that should make a noise does. So whether that's recorded on set or whether you have to record it after, that's something you have to decide. And for film, typically the timeline that I go off of is minimum 8 hours of work per minute of film. And that's like the baseline. That's like if you're working with a documentary that doesn't require a huge amount of extra sound effects or Foley. I have worked on films where it's closer to 30 hours of work per minute of music. And that's not including the score, the composing, that's the dialogue editing, the Foley, the sound effects, the mixing. So it can be quite a massive scale, but that's kind of the timeline or the basis that I would go off of. And then for video games, that is typically a lot harder to manage because you're kind of working at the same pace as the programmers and the animators. And as new animations come available, as new characters come available, then you piggyback on that. And then you're saying, okay, what kinds of sounds does this creature make? Then you can sort of implement it after the other elements have been implemented into a game. So typically the way I'd go about that is I'd play, whenever I'm brought onto a project, I'd play the game wherever it's at And then I start to make my spreadsheet. And video games especially, you end up with hundreds, if not thousands, of different sound effects. So I'd start my spreadsheet, start organizing things into groups, start making notes about what I want, and then go from there. Then you start recording, then you start editing, you start customizing, and then you can either choose to do everything and then implement it at the end, and then you start your mixing process, and you might have to go back and forth a little bit there, or you can continue to implement things as it's done, as it's created.
That's such an intense workload. Yeah. Do you tend to just work on one project at a time because of that?
It honestly kind of depends when the work comes. Sometimes projects will be paused for whatever number of reasons, or deadlines will be extended for any number of reasons. So if it's a big project that you need to work on full time for a while, absolutely, you do that until it's done. If it's smaller projects, sometimes you can pick up a couple at a time. And when deadlines shift, then sometimes your workflow will shift as well.
Sure. Yeah, that makes sense. What skills do you think have served you the best in this career path?
So audio production, for sure. So being able to record, use your DAW, your audio workstation, being able to edit, for sure, and then use all the different plugins that come along with that. And outside of the audio skills, organization is a really huge one. Not only for organizing your sessions and the sound effects that you're working in, but when you work for freelance, you're also running your own business. So just maintaining deadlines, schedule, contracts, all of that. That's a huge, huge element.
For sure. And then for people who are listening who might want to become, maybe they want to be like you when they grow up, they want to do what you do. Do you have any tips on how they can get connected or maybe land their first project in these industries?
Yeah. So a really simple answer to the complex question would be, you first want to learn the skills and build your portfolio. And then you just want to start networking. And there's lots of ways to do that. I'll maybe start with the portfolio aspect. A lot of people are under the impression you need to work on a project and then use that as your portfolio. Definitely not true. You should probably even start to build your skills and your portfolio ahead of time. There's a lot of different ways that people can do that. For the music element, you can just start composing music and you say, this goes with a fantasy game, this goes with an action game, this goes with this type of movie, and start marketing it that way. So you can start composing your film music to some imaginary film, market it that way, and then people already have an understanding of what your style is. Similar with sound design. So building your portfolio can be just creating a sound effects library of a certain type, being able to share that with people. And another really common way is doing sound redubs. So take a scene from, say, a film, video game, remove the sound and redo it in your own style. That's a very common way for people to build their very first portfolio. And that gives people an understanding of your work, what you can do, what your finished products sound like. And then they can go from there. So yeah, so those elements to building a portfolio, really key. And then the second part is networking. So social media is huge for that. There's, starting with exploring the options nearby, if there's film groups nearby, if there's video game groups nearby, see if you can go hang out with those, weekly meetups, monthly meetups, whatever there is. The Global Game Jam is usually at the end of January. That's really fun for people who want to start in the video game industry. You go hang out with a bunch of like-minded people for a weekend, pair off into groups, build a video game in usually 2.5 days. It's very like demo-based, small projects, but it's a really fun way to meet people, network with people. I've definitely gotten jobs from meeting people at game jams before. So you could always see if that's available in whatever area you happen to live in. And then the final thing is just connect with people who are either doing the same thing that you want to be doing or connecting with people that you'd want to work with. So you want to work in film, start connecting with directors and producers. If you want to work as a composer, then again, start connecting with directors and producers. If you want to work in video games, start connecting with the game devs and just start to build those networks. And don't think about it as applying for jobs, but think about it as making friends, right? You just want to connect in the industry. You never know when that next opportunity is going to come up. So just start learning from and connecting with people who are already doing the things that you want to be doing.
That's really good advice. I mean, I think that the challenge of networking is always a challenge. And how do you balance it out and make it so that you're not just, like you said, applying for jobs, you're really connecting with people and making it meaningful.
Yeah, and I think that's a huge part of it. And something that a lot of people have trouble with is not trying to sound sales pitchy, but really just focus on making friends is my best advice, because it can come across as very sales pitchy or inauthentic, really, and people get turned off by that really fast.
In regards to networking, which is with the video game industry and stuff, it sounds easy the way you put it, but I'm sure there's a lot more to it, because just go and meet people is good advice, I guess. But can you kind of elaborate a little bit on that? How did you get into it, like the way you did it, I guess is what I'm trying to say, because there must have been a method to the madness of how you got into doing your work. Yeah,
and like ultimately you can find ways to kind of become someone's go-to person. So for me, I was posting a lot about playing flute. I was posting demos. I happened to have a lot of composers and game dev people that I followed. They followed me back. And at one point, people just started contacting me saying, hey, I need a flute for this. I need someone to record this part for a soundtrack. And then once you've got that contact, you know, you want to make a good first impression, and then that way you become their go-to person. And I think it also comes down to just authentically sharing what you're working on, what you're doing, whether that's something for yourself, your own personal project, something that you're working on that you're allowed to talk about and share, or something that you have a credit in. And just exchanging authentically and becoming kind of that go-to person for the people in your network. And it is hard. It can be difficult.
Yeah, I think it's a struggle for a lot of people on how to be authentic without being super salesy and marketing type and fake and stuff like that. So you managed to get something like 2 billion views on one video, and you had, I think it was something like 50 followers when you did it on your TikTok. Can you kind of go over that, what you posted?
And that was, again, one of those things that was just very authentic, happened very naturally. So I posted a video, just a clip of me recording one of the solo parts for my new song, Spirit Woman. It is a special type of flute that I use called the glissando flute. A lot of people have compared it to a whammy bar for a flute. And I showed it running through a guitar amp plugin, so it creates a really heavy guitar sound. Posted like a 20-second video of this, and people just thought it was really neat. It just took off. So like you said, I went from about 90 followers to more than 4,000 in about a week. It's close to 2 million views now. And in terms of the social media side of that, I mean, it was completely an accident, but I was able to follow up on that really quickly, and it gave me the push I needed to actually learn how to use TikTok, which is something I didn't really do much of before.
Aaliyah, were you gonna say something?
I was just gonna say, TikTok is such a challenge for a lot of people. It's really hard to get going. And once you think you have it figured out, you post something and just crickets. So
yeah.
It's really, really hard to figure it out.
It is, and it also kind of comes down to that you can't really control what people are going to relate to, which I think is also a good reminder to just try and be authentic with your art as well, because you just really can't control what people are going to relate to and what people are going to find interesting.
Are you looking at, in the future, kind of positioning away from doing just the video games and the film, and also getting into like more of the folk metal aspects as like a session type person?
I mean, ideally it would be both, because, you know, I've done a couple session recordings in metal music too. And yeah, I mean, for me, ideally it would be both, and just keep doing both if I can.
Okay, so now, just going back to the beginning here, because we never really talked about this. I know we don't have a ton of time left, but like, kind of, how did you kind of get the idea to meld metal and your flute playing? You didn't really go over that.
The very short answer to that is basically I just wanted to find a way to combine the music that I was playing, which was classical flute music, because I had been put into lessons at a young age, and the music that I like to listen to, because, you know, around 13, I started to discover metal and completely fell in love with it. And it was just always this interest of wanting to find a way to combine those two sounds. So eventually I did learn about, you know, symphonic metal, folk metal, which was super cool. And then from there, just wanted to think, okay, like, can I make this the future instrument? What can I do with it? How far can I take it? And so there was quite a few years of just, you know, the bedroom studio experimentation of finding out like which sounds would go well together, what tones of guitars can you make work with this, and then again it's what sounds can you make the flute do. And then in my case, it was a lot of experimenting with distortion on the flute or guitar amps on the flute and going from there.
Yeah, what you're doing is a little more inventive, a little more creative. It's not, you're not just doing symphonic metal, you're not just doing folk metal, you're really trying to implement some creative solutions there, like putting it through guitar amps and distortion and stuff like that. So I think what you're doing is really interesting, and I'm curious to see where it goes.
Yeah. Well, and I think especially for the really heavier songs, I kind of needed that distortion to really make it fit and not sound out of place. And yeah, so especially with Spirit Woman, that's what I went for that.
I kind of wanted to bring that up because that is the heaviest song on the album. What made you decide to put that as the first single, even though it's not quite representative of the whole album?
Well, I kind of got, you know, pushed a little bit of encouragement there. It also happened to be the first one that was done mixing. I don't know. It was the first one that was done. It was ready to go. So there we have it.
Yeah.
And that did kind of strike me as like, what are people going to think? Are they still going to like the rest of the album once they hear this song? But at the end of the day, I had planned it as a concept album. And with Spirit Woman, I had kind of figured it was either going to be people's favorite song for people who like the heavier stuff, or people's least favorite song for people who maybe were there for more of the folk stuff.
Mm-hmm.
But I mean, either way, it told the perfect story. It fit in perfectly with the album where I wanted it to. So yeah.
And with your flute playing, you also bring it, you do a lot of session work as well with mm-hmm. other musicians. So obviously all the things that you said about networking are relevant here as well. But what do you think are the keys to successful session work as a session musician?
So for sure, you want to provide good quality audio. You want to be set up to deliver that. And again, those communication skills with the composer come in really, really handy as well. And sight reading is also a super important one. So being able to read sheet music. So a lot of the time I am given a piece of sheet music. The session recording stuff usually happens very last in the production process, especially for the indie games, which is what I typically work on. And you often have to turn that around very quickly. So you need to be able to learn the music very quickly, record it well very quickly. Like oftentimes it's just a couple days to a week that I have to turn that around.
Wow.
So yeah, so your sight reading and your ability to learn new music is very good skill to have with that.
That's crazy. I mean, I know some people were like, I saw a post the other day, like, does anyone know a session guitarist who could learn a full set in 6 months? I'm like, I'm pretty sure any session guitarist could do that. If they're a session player, they could do it.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and I think the reason for that too is if you're hired on to do like a big AAA game and you're working with the composer, you're a featured musician, you've probably got quite a bit of time to learn the music. With indie games, I find the way that it works is they're nearing the end of production. They're getting ready to release the game and they're going, oh, we have a couple hundred extra dollars left in our budget. Let's hire some real musicians to add on to this score that we've already created. And so oftentimes the game is maybe just weeks away from release. And so they want that turned around really quickly. They want to be able to add the live instruments in, give it that real element with all the VST instruments that are on the track. And you just have to be able to deliver on that.
So do they usually, you say they usually add it on top of the VST instruments, it usually doesn't replace them?
I mean, it entirely depends on the composer and what they're going for. If they want to layer it or if they do want to replace it, it really depends what their mix process is. Once you do the recordings and you send it off, you often don't have a lot of control over that.
Right, of course. Do you have anything else you want to ask on that, Curtis?
Not on that question. I wanted to go into something else if we could, but
sure.
Cool. That's why I was holding my tongue. So I just want to go quickly back to the promotion that you did here. So the other day you did a Bandcamp listening party, which I don't think too many people have actually done yet. Can you kind of go over your experience with that? Because I wasn't able to make it and I wanted to, but I just saw the last little bit. So can you kind of go over how that works? Like, was it effective, ineffective, that type of thing?
Yeah, I think from what I understand, it's a very new feature that Bandcamp has just started offering.
Just in the last few weeks. That's why I'm asking.
Yeah. And it was good. It was easy to set up. I think I had a couple people who said it was annoying that they had to make an account to have to like RSVP or attend. That, unfortunately, I have no control over. But overall, it was a good experience. It wasn't a huge amount of people, but the people who attended had a lot of fun. Basically, you reserve your time and it plays the album and you have a live chat room. So the chat room opens half an hour before the album starts playing and then it stays open for half an hour afterwards. And it was fun to get to connect with people because there was some people I knew who were going to be there and then also some completely new people who found me on TikTok and Instagram and wanted to come check it out. And so I was able to connect with them in a really fun way. And I thought it was a cool way to premiere my album.
So it's kind of like doing the YouTube premiere type thing where you get the chat and everything. You just kind of sit in there, but it's Bandcamp then.
Yeah, I think so. Or like some sort of Twitch stream, I guess, but you're not on camera. It just had the chat.
Okay, cool. Yeah. And then one more question I had just about the TikTok, because we didn't cover that. Did that translate into anything else other than just views?
Yeah, so several thousand followers.
Of course.
Yeah, and definitely a lot of click-throughs on my Linktree. I had like record number of visits to my website, to my Spotify, everything like that within that first week. And I think the other thing for me personally is it pushed me to understand the platform a bit better, which was kind of always my goal with this release. Mm-hmm. And that just amplified it. So all of a sudden I was learning maybe more efficient ways to publish videos. I learned a lot about how the artist account works and different ways that as a musician, you can effectively promote your music on TikTok and the different assets that are offered through the artist account, how to set that up. And for me, that was the most valuable thing.
Fair. The reason why I kind of bring this up is as you both have had videos go over a million on TikTok. So I'm always kind of interested to know, like, does it really translate for metal people? So you're saying that it helped your Spotify, it helped your Bandcamp and everything else. So you would say that promoting on TikTok is just as good, if not more valuable than Instagram then? Because that's kind of a common complaint we get, is it's not going to be as good for them as Instagram.
Yeah, and I think definitely since that video went viral, I get a lot more, for the most part, I get a lot more interaction on TikTok than I do on basically all of the rest of my social media platforms combined. And I think it also depends on figuring out what people are going to relate to. So now I suddenly have this new audience on TikTok, and I'm learning about, you know, what people respond to, learning about the analytics, best times to post. And so all that, maybe less artistic elements of it, but I still found it's been really effective.
What would you say would be the biggest lesson you've learned from the TikTok experience?
Get your artist account set up before you start releasing stuff.
So what is the artist account again? You told me briefly the other day, and I'm forgetting here. So like, what is, like, you keep bringing this up, like it's an important thing. So what is it exactly?
Yeah. So it's available for musicians, and basically what it does is you link it to your DistroKid or whatever your distributor is. And then it adds a page on your TikTok homepage, which is all of your music. And so in my case, it's all the music I've been featured in as well. So you can use that to link to videos, and that way people can click on the video, and it'll direct them right through to Spotify. So they can save the song on Spotify, they can save the sound, they can remix using your song with their video if you want to. So it kind of keeps all your music in one place and allows you to promote and feature your music in that way. And that way, if someone comes to your page, if they see one video that you like, they come to your page, all of your music is right there for them. Yeah.
Great. Well, I think that's a good place to wrap things up, unless there's something else you wanted to ask Curtis.
No, other than if she wants to just kind of say where people can listen, the name of her album, and where
I was definitely gonna do that.
Cool.
Emma, would you like to tell people where they can listen to your music and drop anything that you want to promote right now?
Yeah, so I am under Ember Belladonna on pretty much every social media platform. I just released a brand new flute folk metal album called The Grove. You can listen on Spotify, Bandcamp, or anywhere else that you get your music.
Awesome. Thank you so much for coming on the podcast. And everyone listening, thank you for listening. And until next time, make like a bull and throw those horns up.
If you enjoyed this podcast, please help spread the word by following or subscribing to us, recommending it to your friends, or leaving us a review on your platform of choice. Thank you for listening to Heavy Business, brought to you by C-Squared Music.